Telling Stories in Different Media. This panel was recorded at SweCon 2015, Confuse in Linköping, Sweden. Participants are Ben Aronovich, Alexander Hallberg, Thomas Ånfelt, Tobias Bordlund, and it is moderated by Jessica Elgenstierna.
SweCon-poddar. En poddradio från svenska science fiction och fantasy-kongresser.
No, I'm good. I was just saying, as long as we have coffee. We're in Sweden, as long as we have coffee, we're good.
Well, I think that's it.
Yeah, go.
Ready, steady, go. Launching. Hello and welcome to this panel, which is going to be a discussion about differences and similarities of storytelling and telling stories in books, games, comics, and TV, I guess, and a little radio maybe. But that pretty much covers it all, except for movies, I think. I don't think we have an experience in movie writing here, but we might cover that as well, who knows. We're going to start this panel with an introduction, so I would like everyone in the panel to say a few words about what media, about yourself and what media you have used for storytelling. Well, we could go from left to right, starting with you.
Yep.
From their point of view,
yeah.
Thomas Ånfelt, writer. I got my first book published this year, and I've also been working as a game designer, both computer games and sort of more on a hobby level as well. I've been doing role-playing games, miniature war games, tabletop games and stuff like that. So that would be basically, I think that's why I'm here. if everyone feels differently, please let me know.
Right. My name is Alexander Hallberg. I'm the president of Sverok, Sweden's gaming organization, which organizes people interested in role-playing games, board games, computer games, and science fiction and fantasy literature in smaller clubs, föreningar, helt enkelt. And my background is I'm also a game designer, more in the role-playing role-playing aspect, but also been a part of doing a couple of board games. From my perspective, we're going to talk a lot about that.
We'll see.
My name is Ben Aronovich. I write books. I did write television. I might write television again if forced to. I've written some radio, and I recently branched out into comics. I've never gone anywhere near games writing, but I have played quite a lot of computer games, and I used to do quite a lot of role-playing and dungeoneering and mastering when I was younger.
Yeah, I'm Tobias Bodlund, and I guess my primary reason for being here is I'm lead scripter for Crusader Kings 2, which is a strategy RPG game. So I write a lot of the stories we tell there, and I'm kind of in charge to make sure those stories stay interesting. And I have a background as well in RPGs. Used to do a lot of role-playing scenarios and GMing and torturing my players, and I write some short stories, weird fiction and stuff in my free time as well.
And my name is Jessica Elgenstierna, and I haven't written any games or TV series or novels, but I'm here representing you as the ones who consume the games and the books and everything, because if there's no one who reads it and no one who takes part of it, it probably doesn't exist. I mean, it's like the tree falling in the forest. Does it even fall if no one's there to hear it? You could. That's an issue for another panel. Well,
especially if you're a squirrel.
But I'd like to start just throwing the word to you, Ben. Ask you a little bit about it. You've written stories in different ways, and you could just elaborate a little bit on your experiences of the differences of the media. What is the basic difference between it, and how do you choose where to do it?
There's two different aspects to differences between media. There's the sort of creative differences, that mm-hmm. is what this particular media can and cannot do, and then there's the sort of practical management side of each media. What are the disadvantages of working in a particular media? For example, if you're writing, I know this from a friend of mine, if you're writing for a XXX game, you are probably facing the most interference that anybody working in any media, including television and film, is ever going to face, because they are cost a couple of billion each, these games, and the management, you have layers and layers of management, starting with usually with Sony somewhere at the top and then working its way down through layers and layers and layers of management, often interlocking forms of management who all have their own ideas. So I call that the kind of bureaucratic nightmare index, and I tend to rate working in the industry by the bureaucratic nightmare index, or BNI, and of which games, apparently, I've never done it because my friend put me off. I've never done games. And then down there, there's like probably movies are next down, and then British television is the next down from that. And then right at the bottom of that list is writing novels, where you really only have to deal with a couple of people. And that's the kind of management side of it. In terms of creative, each of them has its strengths and weaknesses. In novels, you have absolute total control of everything, but it's very hard to do surprise people visually, because it's all words. Whereas in a comic, you can do a splash page, you can turn over a page, and you can have this big, bold image on the next page, and everyone goes, wow! And it makes an immediate sensory impression. And comics are really good at time. In comics, you can go backwards and forwards in time, you can have what's known as ironic counterpoint, with the words don't match the images. You can change the art style mid-flow in a way that doesn't break up the concentration of the person reading it, which you can't do in television or film, which you can't do in the other audiovisual media. So all of these have kind of like pros and cons. And I like working in all of them, except, of course, the BNI can get very high, and I don't like dealing with people. I'm not very good with people, really. I keep biting them. So for me, there is, general terms, there's like the differences. You can do things, you can do certain stories tell better in prose than tell better. For example, you want to do a kind of deep story about someone's emotional state in the breakup of their marriage. Generally, you want to go for a novel. A comic. You could do it in a comic, but it would be a bit weird, if you really wanted to get the kind of interiority of someone's emotions. A first person or a third person novel would probably be better. Kick-ass space opera, you can do in anything. That's what I like about space opera. But horror works very well in certain mediums, much better. You can do creepy horror in books, but I think for sheer kind of gut-wrenching terror, you really can't miss cinema but really, really good. It's games. Some games I won't play. I just refuse to play body horror games, because I'm just like, no, because it's you and you're going down the corridor, and that's even worse than watching somebody else do it. So, and something leaps out. I remember there was a bit in Uncharted, the first Uncharted game, where you go into the U-boat pens, and suddenly it turned into a horror game, and I was like, and I made my son play that part of the game. So.
Ouch. But we're going more into this. This is a very game-heavy panel, so we are definitely going more into games later on. But I would like to ask the other one, apart from you also, Thomas, have experiences of writing novels as well as games. Mm-hmm. Can you share a bit about your thoughts about it, the differences? You went from one thing to the other. Never return, or
no. I think that depends on the opportunities, basically. But I think, as Ben said, writing a novel is very much a one-man show. A apart from having an editor and feedback and stuff. But that's the stuff you kind of ask for to improve your own story, because you know it won't be good enough if it's just me. I need some help to reach that level. Whereas when you're writing games, unless you're doing my hobby projects, because they are just me as well. Because, but computer games, there, even if you're in a smaller company, because I've been in a couple of these sort of mini companies doing mainly Facebook games and online games and stuff like that. Even though you don't have the extreme amount of layers, you're very close to the guy who's actually holding the money, the one who's paying your salary. And even though you have sort of an agile development structure with closed sprints, nothing can be changed during those 2, 3, 4 weeks. Of course, management will change things. I wasn't into that, but a friend of mine was the main game designer for a game based on the Playboy brand, actually. Mm. It's pretty cool. And they had a game design kind of worked out, framed out, and started working on it. And then management said, no, it should be like Farmville.
Oh.
Because that sells. And they were like, it won't work. It's already been done, but not in that way, but it won't work. But of course, no one listens to us, so it became a Playboy Farmville game that sort of flopped.
where was the story? Was there a story?
The story was actually what was kind of thrown out along the way there. So I think my sort of concluding point is that whether you're writing a novel or you're writing a game, in order for it to actually be really good, it has to have some kind of story element that is really good in it. I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's easy to dismiss games if you're not... I mean, I'm sorry if I sound obnoxious, but it's easy to dismiss it as a bit commercial, sellout. It's not like the it's not as... highly regarded, it hasn't got the same status as novels, unfortunately. But I mean, that doesn't mean that you're not need to care about story. I guess. I mean,
I think it's an underestimated part of game design, actually, because usually the top management guys only see the monetizing features, whereas you, as the game designer or story writer or whatever you're working as, you feel like if we're going to make money on this game, it has to have a story, or at least story elements that carry, that people can sort of relate to or bring with them, scare them. Or I mean, even such games as I've been working a lot with, as I said, miniature war games where you play with soldiers and stuff like that. If unexpected things can happen that lead to something else, that lead to something, you will, in your head, create a story around that. And those are the games you then remember. Those are the ones you really like. So I think there's that part to it. It's brilliant doing storylines for games. It's really, really fun, but you're always working against that sort of...
What do you say about that, Tobias?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot, because you have different, you know, different types of games, different genres, because often when you have like Facebook games or online games where you have maybe you have a lot of microtransactions and stuff, and then the whole game design is likely to revolve around how can you make people spend more money and so on, how can you frustrate someone to pay money to get another life or whatever. And then you have the design is focused around that monetizing thing, but you know, like games type of games I make, or if you have like big I don't know, Mass Effect or whatever, that type of game, which has, they have an artistic ambition level which is much higher than, I presume, the Facebook Playboy games. I haven't played it. But there's kind of those games make money because everyone who's played them go like, wow, this is so amazing, you should play this game. That, you know, there you have, you're creating a fantastic piece of art and people love it, and that's why it sells well. So in those cases, I guess the monetizing does not come into conflict necessarily with artistic ambition, or, you know.
Except those where you're sort of, your storytelling wants you to do sort of branch out, and management says, no, we can't have content that everyone doesn't see because we can't spend that much money.
Oh, yeah, I think you'll always have some kind of frustration from the business side of it. But you know, it's, I mean, for example, on MMOs, something that, you know, is clear there, you know, if you look at a really fantastic MMO like, I don't know, Star Wars The Old Republic or World of Warcraft is a game a lot of people like, you might think that, oh, this is such great content, such an interesting story, this quest here I'm playing, but, you know, it's so annoying because I have to run 10 minutes there and run 10 minutes back to collect the reward, and that's designed into the game because, you know, there's a calculation how much time you should be spending in the game because it's a monthly subscription. Those are the kind of things that come in, you know, when there's a business model, you know, that you can notice it that. I don't know if anyone here has thought about it, but, you know, as a work with game design myself, I notice these things. And I mean, one thing that's very obvious also, there can be a frustration when designing video games is you have a, you know, I mean, you have a budget, like films have a budget. You're like, oh, can we have, we're going to make an army about Genghis Khan. Let's have 300,000, you know, extras here with the realistic armor and so on. And someone's like, yeah, you know how much that costs? And we're seeing a lot more of these huge war movies, like medieval war movies in later years, because CGI can make those armies. Yes. That's a lot cheaper, you know.
No longer have to get the Russian army.
Yeah. We have some computer nerds sitting in a room making the armies. We don't have to hire 500,000 actual people. I don't know how many extras they had in the Russian War and Peace epic movie they made, but that was very expensive. But they had, I think they had like tens of thousands of actual extras in the armies. This was in the 1960s.
They actually had whole regiments.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in that way, I guess role-playing is different. I mean, the kind of games you've been writing for.
Well, yeah.
It's not as expensive, I mean.
You know, if you're talking about the doing game, to actually art of making games, making a role-playing game is much more like writing that, an actual novel. I think that if I just want to comment shortly on making the bigger games in the bigger companies, you know, the good things about that is you get a collective creation project process. There's a lot of different, you have to, there's a lot of really talented people, you know, to put their talents together and create these amazing games. But for me, you know, it's kind of, the medium is the message is a really old saying. I think that's really what differs gaming from novels, because it's not only the story. It can be a game with a really, really great story, but if the gameplay sucks, then you're never going to play the game, and it's going to fail miserably. So making stories for a game, you have to balance the gameplay with the story, because you're not just telling a story, you're giving this story as a concept to the player who's there making the decisions, or at least thinks he or she making the decisions, because gaming can also have the really nice mechanic of the illusion of choice. And as long as I, as a player, feels that, hey, I'm playing the story, and I'm creating it as I go along, but they actually not creating anything new at all, and it differs very, very little from each player.
Sometimes they are.
Yeah, but sometimes. But those really, those games that where you are really creating the story yourself in computer games are really, you know, it's like facade. It's really, they're really rare. But in the RPGs, well, there's nothing else than storytelling. The whole game is a storytelling game. I mean, most of the games, you know, there's kind of, if I'm going to generalize this, it's kind of two kinds of storytelling, RPG, role-playing tabletop games. One where you get an actual world and a setting, and you're like thrown into it, and they say create your own story, and here you have some pointers to go along for the way. Like if you want to play in the Call of Cthulhu games, they obviously taking place in the worlds of H.P. Lovecraft and that kind of mythos. But then you have the other kind of games where you're just giving a system. So here you have a system for resolving conflicts, and you can play whatever you want. You can play in an evil setting, you can play in a space opera setting, but here you have the rules that help you create this story. There's a fantastic game called Fiasco, where you all play criminals that are going to do, you know, the last heist. So it's kind of the Italian Job, the Ocean's 11, the Coen brothers kind of themed. And you all start out making your characters and just making your relations and deciding how your character is going to fail. So you only know those three things, just kind of your name and your gender, if you want that, how you know the other persons, and how you're going to miserably fail in the last one. And then you together make up this story as you go along. And that changes the whole perspective, because there is no single author. You're yourself, you know, me and Thomas can, in real time, making my story. So how am I, my character is going to end up in this miserable ending that I have figured out. And there's a collective responsibility for me to, you know, to reach that point and to have a great experience. Because if you play a role-playing game where you only focus on your own story, well, that's really.
There's a card game called Gloom, which this makes me think of as well.
Yeah,
but that's a very good point, because you can have procedural elements in a role playing system that determine the type of story, and you can get that kind of dissonance, because if you say, for example, start playing Call of Cthulhu, you've never played it before, it takes you a while to realize that you're playing in a system which is stacked against your character, that your character will probably die or go insane at some point. And the longer you play, the more likely your character is to die or go insane.
Yeah.
And you then have to kind of make that, you realize that I'm not telling the story of someone who's going to be triumphant. I'm telling the story of someone who is doomed, struggling against the inevitable triumph of the, you know, the old ones.
Yeah.
And the system reflects that. And also another really good example from the same company is Pendragon.
Yeah.
Where this whole system is designed to make you crave glory because you are a knight. And so you put glory above everything else, and you have to play it in that way or you can't play it properly.
Yeah.
So you can't play it as a doomed investigator if you're playing Pendragon and vice versa. And that's the very important part of, even in simulationist games, which is Call of Cthulhu and Pendragon are, the way they simulate reality is very important to dictating the way the story is told, the way the story you tell in within the story is told. I always find that very sneaky and fun.
I think we have a recurring red thread here that is about control. You had your index thing.
BNI.
Your BNI. But I was thinking about you're talking from the perspective now of a player, and that is not really in all that much in control, maybe, or something, but at the same time, you who write games, you're not all that much in control. I mean, basically, if in some games, I guess you can really make people go through a very special road, but in MMOs, you really can't guide them. I mean, you write a book, and people will probably read it from page one to the last page. They won't read every second page or from backwards or something. They will
read it differently.
Yeah.
They will come up with radically different interpretations of your world.
But I mean, if you have a person who's playing World of Warcraft, you have no idea if they're going to read your lore and your backstory or anything. They can just kill 10 goats and then they go forward and do something else. You have no idea if they actually read your stories.
Is it about killing goats?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, or boar or whatever. Yeah,
and rats.
But if you
have urban control,
how does it feel to be out of control? How do you deal with that as a game writer? Is that, you're posted into it, aren't you?
Yeah, but it's like, as you say, this is the illusion of choice, because you as a player can feel like, ha, screw the game also, I'm not following this story, while the game also says, well, you're actually doing exactly what I want you to do now, because the story is meant for you not to follow it. If you follow it, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of walking 10 minutes, killing 10 boars, and then, you know, getting the, you know, you're always saying that, oh, in World of Warcraft you can like do everything, but the game is actually really narrow, and you kind of fill it out, the blank spots, with your own imagination, and makes it like, oh, we had a wedding, and like, well, you met on a hill in the game, and there's no in-game system for weddings or anything, so that kind of transcends from what it was supposed to be into another thing, because the players themselves stuck layers on it. And I think that's the interesting thing when storytelling is really good, and when it's its best, is when it challenges the conventions of its own medium, you know. Yeah, when you can get that game that really surprises you, or that book that really, you know, break new borders, or, yeah.
Well, there was a definite tendency when you were playing GTA Vice City, just to get yourself a hot car and put the radio on, and to something like Something in the Air Tonight, and just cruise around. and not even like shooting up all people, or you know, obeying the traffic laws. I used to go around like stopping at red lights and everything.
I would say that's a player taking control of the game.
I just remember doing that.
Did you ever stop in a car park for half an hour and listen to the talk shows on the radio?
Yes, I did. Or pull over, or just go, what's that over there?
I think that's the fun part. I mean, I was complaining a bit about management interruption, but I think, as you were saying, part of the fun part is, of course, the collaboration, the team. Because you can throw out an idea and someone will turn it upside down and inside out, and it'll be brilliant and not at all what you thought it would be. But the other thing is like doing something and then trying to guess what the players will do with it.
Yeah.
Because how much you guess, they will always come up with something else.
Well, I'm waiting to see what bizarre things people do in No Man's Sky.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's just an insane game. And I think people are going to come up with things that nobody's ever dreamed of to do on these kind of millions and millions of planets. And they're going to find things that nobody knows exists because it's procedurally driven. And I think I'm quite keen to find out what kind of happens in that. I think people are going to try and break that game so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's to go back to what you said before, Ben, it's like, what's really the big difference in storytelling between novels or computer games or games in general is part to, well, the player or the reader, what kind of choice does he or she have to influence the story, or at least think they can influence the story, and the problem and potential of the visualization. Because if you have a game and you can, as you said, you can have a horror game and you can actually see the monster popping out and really scare you. But at the same time, if you do that in a bad, with bad graphics or in a bad man, you know, it will be a flop. It's not good. Yeah. How do you tackle that when, you know, you have the novel, because you have the words to visualize things? But how much can you count on or control the reader's imagination?
It's this tricky thing called theory of mind, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you have to imagine you're the reader reading the stuff that you're writing. And it can get nested. It can go, I am a reader reading the stuff that I've written, that I'm writing for the stuff, knowing that the guy is going to react a certain way. It's like, you know, I know you know, we know,
yeah.
I know Inception. You know. And in the end, actually, you can't think like that. No. You just have to get on with it, because otherwise you just spend your whole time like this. Yeah. And you never write anything. No. I mean, I do that. One of the most beautiful thing is for writing for comics. And I hadn't written for comics, and I swear it is the easiest writing you can possibly do. It is the absolute easiest. Wow. And the reason for this is, like, in all other forms of writing, like in novels, you have to write every single word of description, and it's all going to be read by the person, right? Even if you write a script, right, it doesn't actually just go to the people who are making it. It has to go out to the financiers, and everyone has their input, and everyone has to read it. So it has to be written in a particular way to sell the idea of the script to people. Try and say, look, this is going to look really exciting when it's on the screen. And when you write a comic, the only person you are talking to is the artist. Mm-hmm. The only person. So if you know them quite well, you just go, yeah, have a big page of, I don't know, something there that was exciting. And all the only thing you actually, that you write that anyone ever sees apart from the artist is the dialogue. And dialogue is like 5% of a good comic is 5% of a good comic. So everything else is just sort of like, talking to the artist. So it's like talking, especially, and this is why you'll find people who get friends with artists and they use the same artist again and again and again. Because you just use shorthand. You go, you know, something like you did the other day with a big explosion in a car. And, you know, you can get detailed. You can get detailed. Alan Moore writes these incredibly long things if you read an Alan Moore script. You know, every single frame is detailed down. And sometimes you do that if you have a very clear idea of what it looks like. But sometimes you just go, and then an accident happens. And you let the artist do it. And that's so that all the pressure is off you because you don't have to come up with how the accident happens. You just give it to the artist. So it's like great. And,
random
accident. And so it's the most fun I've ever had in front of a word processor, because it's just like every time I came to a point where in a novel I'd be going, oh, what happens, you know, what does this look like, can I think of a description for this? No, I just write a car hits a post and it's up to him to make it look exciting. It's like, you know, a car crash with blood and guts, you know what I like, da da da, up to page two. So instead of like taking like what would take me 3 weeks to write on a comic, I can knock out a comic in a week because there's no kind of like mediating. There's no kind of it's like, you know, light going through a medium. It's like going through a vacuum. It's like writing through a vacuum. It's brilliant.
I think you found your new media here. Well, yesterday you said you keep writing until you get a job
comics have their disadvantages as well.
Yeah,
one of them being is you have to find an artist. And the buggers know they're in demand because, like, you know, whereas everyone thinks they can write, almost nobody actually can draw. Mm. So, and particularly comic drawing, where you have to like have people's faces that are recognizable from frame to frame to frame to frame, and you need someone who can do what 22 pages in a month if you're going to keep up your production schedule. So people like that, you know, don't grow on trees, and they know it.
Someone who's good at working with a writer as well, because it is a collaborative effort.
It's collaborative thing. Yeah. So you can't have someone who's going, no, I don't like the way you did that. I'm going to completely change the story by reframing it.
Who just never understands what you're trying to say to them.
Or in my case, we had the first artist we tried was an American artist, and he kept on giving back these shots of, because this was Rivers of London comic, and we're going, that's not London. It's just like, couldn't you just look on Google Earth at some point and see that that's not London? Whereas the artist we've got now is a British, so at least, although the colorist is Mexican and lives in Mexico City, which just goes to show you.
Can you say something about radio as well? Audio, you're written for audio. What's special about that?
Audio, I love and hate. Audio, the budget is tremendous. Special effects budget is unlimited. The trouble is, you have to come up with new ways of saying, over there, a man with a gun! Right? And after like the eighth time you said, what is that? I don't know, it's a man with a gun. You start running out of ways of doing that, and you get really sick of people describing things to people. What can you see? You know, what can you see? I see a man with a gun. So you're fine for like the first three episodes, and then after a while you start going, oh god, how do I describe someone looking at a spaceship again? You know, and it's like, and you can get around it. So that's why some of the most successful radio stuff is humor, like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because he then plays upon that. You hear me? He had sound effects, like bizarre sound effects that counterpointed it was. Or the Goon Show scripts where, you know, someone will hail a taxi and the sound of bagpipes will appear. Or my favourite, which is have a gorilla. No, try one of my monkeys, they're milder. And it's like they have this joke running through the whole thing. And when they do light up, it's the sound of two... It's described in the script as the sound of two gorillas fighting. And so radio is good in that respect, in that you can actually be quite mad and it's cheap. And actors really like doing it. You can get really, really good actors really, really cheaply, because for them it's kind of fun. They just go in for 2-3 days into a studio, hang out with other actors. They don't have to dress up. They don't have to wait around for lighting and camera technicians and special effects. And they like it. So it's all the fun of the theatre without having to slog through weeks and weeks and weeks of the same production. So they really enjoy that. So you can get some really top, especially in Britain, where the actors are not that proud, you can get some really top flight actors. And I've worked some very, very, very... Jeffrey Palmer, who was frightening, as a frightening actor, and how good he was. And that's a lot of fun. So you're collaborating with some very fine people.
But you can actually mix it. I mean, I'm an avid Zombies Run gamer. Is there anyone else here? Runner number five? Anyone? No? No? Zombies
I
Run.
I know what it is.
Yeah. Zombies Run game is absolutely the best way to get in shape. I mean, it's tremendous. Most of us are geeks who hate doing exercise, but if you're chased by zombies, it gets way more fun. But it's the thing about Zombies Run, it's written by an author. That's the main part. That's why it's so successful. They hired Naomi Alderman, and she's a real writer. I mean, and she's written novels, and they say it over and over again that she teamed up with a game company, but she was a real author, and it's always story first. But I was thinking about that is like radio theater. It's played in second person. So you're number five, you're running with your headset on, and you get instructions to do things, and you hear people talking to you on the headset all the time. They are, oh, today you're on a mission there, and then you go there, and someone is talking to you, and scary stuff happens, and you like break your heart and everything. But I was thinking about, could this become a trend? I mean, have you thought about it as a writing for games, that audio games is a thing? I mean, we all have those apps and stuff. Could it become more common to do that kind of writing?
I love the idea. It sounds great.
Yeah. But I think there's at least with the phones and everything, it's definitely a mark there for mixing different modes of storytelling that'll have to be explored, and that will be explored, I'm pretty sure. Also mixing books and games and stuff like that. So
it's actually I know a couple of board games that's using that. You're playing the board game with a CD on the other side that's giving instruction. A really common theme for that is like you're all trapped on a spaceship, something went to hell, and now we have this, you know, audio thing that's saying what kind of enemies they're coming over on, or when you can talk or not allowed to talk. It's a really great game called Space Alert. You can check it up on Board Game Geek, who's using that mechanic. So I think that's kind of more of a tool to enhance or transcend the storytelling more than an actual way of telling the story yourself, at least in the gaming perspective.
I have considered doing, because my books are so localized, I love the lovely term localized. I have an app on my phone, which is the police app, which will show you where crimes are. I would have considered that it might be fun to do an investigative detective game where you have your phone and it's operating through the camera. And the GPS system, and it will show you, and it will say, here is the crime, here is the crime scene, and then it will use the phone to project, like, the outline of the body onto the thing and say, this is a clue here. And although I do suspect you'd get, like, loads of people clustering around the same place. And if I could delocalize that somehow so that it would work in any city, that would be a really good thing. I suppose you could, because what you would do is you'd have to key it off, like, a barcode or something, or you'd say, what city am I in? But I would love to do something like that.
An augmented reality game
where you just kind of have your phone. And I don't know, I suppose you could sell it by saying they're kind of invisible spirit. It's quite good for mine, because I can say that your phone is now adapted so you can see ghosts.
That would be great for Google Glass.
Except then you would look like a tit. I mean, people look bad enough when they're like Siri, like that into their phone, without actually having a Google Glass.
But some interesting stuff has been done with this kind of, you know, Google Maps but this audio game zombie run thing sounds great, and an interesting thing there is there's so much being made in video games where, like, you have new interesting tech and people try to do interesting stuff with it, and sometimes it sucks and sometimes it works. But I mean, we talk about video games, and the word implies that it's a visual thing only, right, or something. But, you know, there are a lot of other stuff you can do with electronic games, you know, computer games. And just two interesting examples that spring to mind now that are quite new stuff that's done. They're a bit, you know, different from what we're used to. Is one example is something they're doing in GTA Online, where they use the voice chat. You have in-game voice chat, so you can hear what people are saying near you. But they're also using that in the game design. So, you know, GTA, you're usually a terrible person. So let's say you're robbing a gas station.
And if you scream into your microphone while robbing, they will shuffle the money quicker for you. So that hasn't really been done a lot before in games, but this is a detail which is hilarious because, well, you know, you could be walking down a street, you know, and you hear from a window someone is shouting, "Give me the fucking money!" Yeah. And it's just some uncanny detail. Another thing which... I came back from Gamescom yesterday, actually. That's why I'm a bit hoarse today. And I was watching a demo with eye-tracking technology, where so you have a little camera on top of your computer screen, and it can track your eye movements. And I saw some prototypes of how they use that in games. And basically, you could use that to... that's connected in as a controller, basically. So if I look at the screen, then maybe that could move the mouse cursor to where you are looking. And then maybe I wink and it clicks there. You can do any kind of stuff like that. And what they had done was I saw a demo where they had integrated into an Assassin's Creed version with this, which they were just demoing. I don't think it's commercial yet. So you would run with the normal controls, and then some soldier would show up there, and you just look at the soldier, and the camera focuses there where you're looking, and that controls the camera. And I'm thinking, my stuff we could do with this with horror games, for example. I see something weird at the corner of the screen. I look, and it's gone. You know.
Playing that.
Think about what's happening here. It's actually you're looking, like we say, video games. We're seeing something, but here's actually the game is looking at you. You know, I could have so much fun with that. With what I was thinking.
I've been shown the 5 minutes thing here, and I've kept it tightly under control. But the index is going down now, so I'm leaving it over to the audience. If there are some questions here, final or remark, yes.
You talked a bit about how a game needs both mechanics and stories to work properly, sir. But some games downgrade their mechanics in favor of the story. Mm. So is that okay for some games more than others? Or, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, emo games, you can downgrade, you know, like Vampire the Terminal Depression.
Is that a show?
You can downgrade the mechanics quite a lot. You know, you don't have to be simulationist about it. Or my favorite is the Munchausen game, which is like you just lie. Just like that's got almost no rules at all. And some games, but when I'm playing like a detailed, you know, traveler, I want some rules. I want some crunch. I don't want to be kind of rolling random bunches of six dice. I want to know exactly what the power to weight ratio of my bloody spaceship is. Thank you very much, because that's the setting. The setting is about how much power to weight ratio your spaceship has.
Yeah.
And so I think it's entirely setting dependent, really, on that sort of thing.
Yeah, you have to realize that, like, in the gameplay and the mechanics as well as some writing techniques, there are just tools for you to present the story in different ways. And some kinds they can be a hinder, you know, and just really bad menus or bad UI or something that makes you not want to play the game because it's not enjoyable. But then on the other hand, you have games like the Munchausen games or a really nice card game that's called Once Upon a Time, where you just get a set of cards with different things on, like a river, a queen, the lost treasure, and then you're supposed to tell a story. And every time you implement one of these things in the story, you'll be able to play that card. And the game's goal is that you don't want to have any cards on your hand. So that's a really simple and neat system, but that doesn't really... it nudges your story a little bit.
I think the key is honesty when it comes to the mechanics.
Yeah.
If they're true to the type of game you want to portray, then it'll work regardless of whether they're complicated or simple, regardless of whether they... cover it all, just ask you to sort of make up as you go. I think as long as they're not trying to give you the illusion of being super complicated, it's okay if they're simple.
I have a question. I like first edition CNS, so Chivalry and Sorcery, you guys are all too young. First edition CNS was wonderful because it was like D&D, but really, really complicated.
It was.
I loved it. I mean, you used to roll for your star sign. as part of the character creation process. I just loved that. And I loved it. I had six pages on alchemy, on how to make the Philosopher's Stone, that I could see no game use for whatsoever. I just loved having it.
First session. Yeah, I love, you know, the old Traveller games where your character could actually die during character creation. Yeah.
It's like... I think that should be important into all character games. Because it teaches you a valuable lesson. Yeah.
But you have to ask yourself every time you had the gameplay, is this furthering the story, or is it giving the players more or less control, and why?
Yeah,
you
know, and because is this fun?
Yeah, exactly. And it's always have to be fun or engaging.
Well,
monetizing.
Which is a very good way to wrap up this. Yes. I mean, we have different media. We have books, games, TV, comics, but they always have to be entertaining and fun, yeah, and for profit.
fun.
I think
no profit is very important.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe a minute.
Okay. Is there any very quick or final remark for you? If someone hasn't spoken enough, please speak up now.
Or be forever silent.
Or should we need to forever remain silent on that?
I hope people make more.
Yeah, one more
question.
What was the game called you talked about?
Oh, Zombies Run.
The old one. Chivalry and Sorcery, you can still get on eBay, but trust me, it's not worth it. Unless you have a particular kind of brain, it's really.
I can kind of agree with you there. Yeah.
Very quickly, yeah. If you don't want to run, the company's made a walking version. This kind of.
And what's it called?
You walk through the entire Britain.
It's the same walk. Company. Yeah. As something. Yeah. I don't remember what it's called though.
It's called the walk. Yeah. You walk through Britain. Yeah.
We got the stuff. It's a kind of a spy story, yep, thing.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Where you look at your screen, actually. But we got to stop here, I think. We got the stop sign, so thank you very much.
Gärna vår hemsida på svekonpoddar.se.